Welcome to Life, Death, Sci-Fi. This is episode... we don't even know. Episode 5 or 6?
It always feels like the first one to me. Ringworld. I looked him up a little bit on a sci-fi website, and this guy is 81 years old now. He's still alive. 81 seems old to me, but not too far away, really. And he wrote his last book last year.
Yeah, I Googled him real quick just to make sure I was pronouncing his name correctly. And I saw that he was recently brought to Google to give a talk.
Oh, wow. I would go to hear him talk. And guess what? His last book was written about the Kazin. Is that Chimi? One of the main characters? The speaker. Yes.
Yeah, the speaker is speaker to animals.
Speaker to animals.
Which it never really explains, does it? I think the first thing he says is, I will tie your necks in a bow knot.
Sounds aggressive to me. But it's probably just saying hello.
Yeah, exactly.
Hi, how are you doing? In the cast of characters, we have the Chimi Kazin, Louis the Human, Tila the Human, and one of my favorites, the Hindmost, Nessus the Puppeteer. I have a lot to say about him, her, it, do I dare say, and Pril later on in the story, Pril.
Right.
I don't think there were too many other characters that were, you know.
A little quick mention of the Seeker, I suppose, at some point. Now, you've read on. You said you've read another...
I read this the second book, and spoiler alert, this Seeker doesn't last too long. We have been watching, reading about aliens for years and years now. I grew up reading about aliens, watching them on TV. And now it's so easy for me to believe in another being from another planet. What about you?
Yeah, I think that's always made sense to me, or I've always felt like, well, I mean, you know, by watching those shows with my parents growing up, it was always ever present, I guess, this idea or different versions of that. So definitely, you know, it's definitely something I can believe is true. As I'm saying that, I'm trying to think of there's some kind of theory on that, right? About in terms of the probability of that being true.
Oh, yeah. There's so much written about, is there sentient life out there somewhere? And if you talk to people on the streets, I would bet you that 90% of the people have some sort of opinion. And I bet you that more than 50% would say, yes, they believe in life from outer space.
Yeah.
Have you seen the movie Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets?
No.
You didn't see this movie?
No. In fact, I'm trying to think about Valerian sounds familiar, but I don't think I've heard of it.
Oh, you must see it then. And it's been around now, so it's out there, easy enough to see.
All right.
The introduction to this movie is how the space station became bigger and bigger as they welcomed alien species. It starts out with just welcoming, like the Russians, the Soviets come and they plug in and everybody's so happy. But then as the introduction grows, there are more and more species of different worlds come to join. And that's how it became a city of 1,000 planets. And this introduction showed how many variations that people can think of. And that's what reminded me of the puppeteer, the Hindmost.
Yeah, fascinating concept, and really one that seems likely. This expanding space station idea is pretty interesting.
Yeah. Oh, and the story is lovely. I think you will like it. And if you can watch it on a big screen, that's what you should do.
Okay.
So we've got this Hindmost two-headed creature that can look into its own eyes. So the physiology is interesting. Behavior explained by his or her title, the Hindmost. And I think what really, and for authors, this is pretty good, is to move things on alien beliefs. Like the Kizen had a whole different value system and belief system than Lewis and Teela, the humans on board. I enjoyed that. That's the puppeteer part. And which I think for me, this was not particularly a story of the giant, huge world that Larry Niven created. The ring world is hard to imagine the way he described it. Lovely description about how big something like that has to be and what kinds of things hold it together. Yeah. It was fascinating, but I thought the heart of this story for me was the eugenics of it. I think you're exactly right about Teela really realizing that she never had free will. It's always been manipulated by her luck. But she also took advantage of slacking off on her moral responsibility. Maybe she never saw that she should have moral responsibility, but for someone who has incredible luck, that really probably wouldn't play into life that much. You just float on through.
Yeah, and yet in the end, Lewis seems to be... Did you pronounce his name Lewis?
Yeah, why? Is it...
Oh, no, I don't know. I didn't think about it until I said it out loud. I suppose it could be Louis, but that Lewis...
Oh, yes, my Uncle Louis. He had that, too. Let's call him Louis.
I don't know, it might be hard for me. I've been thinking of Lewis, I think, the whole time, but... That Louis,
oh.
Lewis, I think you can't do it.
Either one.
We'll know when they release a series, right, which will be exciting.
We should make some predictions about that at the end. We think that...
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I'll make a little note about that, predictions. And argues in the end, toward the end, he's arguing that what her luck actually was, that she starts to be slightly... seemingly unlucky, that she burns her feet, that she has this trauma through the eye, and that these things happen to her so that she can then, these tragedies around her, so she can grow and mature and gain experience that'll help her become more fully human, because because she's constructed by the puppeteers in a way, in their version of what they think would be godlike, that the luck in the end is how she can, luck causes her to become human. Does that make sense?
I really like that. A lot of that makes sense to me.
Which becomes like kind of a key part of the story arc, really, that I guess I wasn't really expecting. But in terms of a way of exploring questions about, let's say, luck/fate, versus choice, freedom, free will. I guess that makes sense, right?
When I was reading it, I think this is my second read. I read it a long, long time ago. When I was reading it, I was really trying to get clarity on that. I almost got it. And then you know how some concepts, ideas, then it gets away from you. But talking with you and even reading the small article that this guy had on his book, Free Will and Moral Responsibility, how luck undermines that is powerful stuff. And then I think, okay, here are these puppeteers, these aliens that are manipulating us through eugenics. And then the other example of the Kizen making them into, docile, more docile so they could deal with them. I think maybe, is that true? Are we in some huge eugenics experiment and that our lives are really manipulated by some greater force? Is that a good enough conspiracy theory?
Yeah, it's challenging, I guess, notions of, is that what God does? Are we the matrix of sorts that we're all in?
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like that. And I think sometimes we all feel like that. And is that a feeling that we should let it be explored and find out, take the red pill or blue pill? Was it blue pill?
Yeah. It has me also thinking about whether, is it suggesting that some races or animals or species they're all of some like significance to some, it just has me thinking about the consumption of animal. Do we, should we be eating animal species, or do we only feel like we can because we've been manipulated over the generations to feel like some animals have less value than others. If we're really thinking about what's sentient, then, you know, we probably shouldn't be eating pig or octopus. And yet we eat those and we don't eat dogs and cats, but, you know.
Yeah, I get, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I think science fiction lets you see eugenics a little more clearly because we're already in the scope of space, which is this limitless place. And eugenics only works over time. And so you're in this place of infinity and you can look at eugenics and say, oh yeah, with just a little manipulation here or there over this many generations, we can get this.
Yeah, there's a lot of playing God in this text. And I think the other one that's there is the idea of living longer and longer lives through this booster spice. And then there's something else toward the end.
Tree of life. Yeah. Well, it's in mythology, isn't it?
I was wondering if, Lewis would, he's bringing back some kind of pill or he's going to share that when he trades Hela for that.
It will be. It's revealed in the second book for sure.
Okay. Yeah, it seemed like it would come back to that. How long?
Yeah,
how long would you want to live? I suppose if I could explore unknown universes, I don't know. I think I would want to live for a long time. Yeah. You read Altered Carbon. I've only seen the series, but it reminds me.
Oh, you have. Oh, that's right. The series was really pretty good, but the book was pretty awesome too.
Yeah, it's
all. Yeah, maybe we'll have to put that on the list because there's some really good stuff in that about, yeah, that long longevity stuff. The other place that I think there are a couple places, but one place that really affected me with eugenics in our readings has been in The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. The eugenics of slavery in the United States. It's been a kind of a recurring theme in at least three of the books that we've read. I can't remember what the other one was, but eugenics and science fiction seem to be connected in some way.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, the Underground Railroad's new. There's something to be said about when this is written. So it's published in 1907. I just wonder is there some kind of some views and things that aren't quite as nuanced or developed as maybe they would be nowadays. So I don't know, when I hear about eugenics, it just kind of there brings to mind ideas of racism. And I don't know that I got, and there's certainly some tone throughout this in which Lewis seems, I mean, I have to go back and really kind of maybe dig into some quotes, but does he seem to, he seems to have a kind of an arrogance, like old kind of experienced white guy. And I always wonder was there a bit of the author, you know, in that? Although when this was, you know, written, if he's 80, so that's 50 years ago, right? He was 30 when writing this, so he wasn't an old guy writing it.
Yeah, that's true.
But, and then I think along the same lines is that there's certainly some aspects of this in which, or some moments, really the portrayal of women in this is not very flattering. I'd be thinking of Heinlein.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I did.
It's not as blatant. Heinlein just smacks you with it. And I don't know. I've read some things about Heinlein that he was pushed that way because of the publishers, which speaks of a deeper thing, but then authors should write what they believe in themselves. So
yeah, I don't know.
I struggle with the idea that the author a long time ago was this way, and should I like that author's works as well in light of my attitudes of today? I don't know. I haven't resolved that quite yet, but it feels, I don't know.
Yeah, we talked about that in a bit more depth with, and I don't know if we need to go in depth here. I just thought it was notable. You know, just the women are portrayed as, there's always question about intelligence, right? It's like, oh, Tila's, and I get that she's younger. Is Tila Brown, oh, she was actually a little smarter than I thought. And then the way even Prilla is portrayed in the end, that she's, and sure, she's learned how to speak, but she seems wondering whether she's intelligent or not. He seems to be a bit superior. Yeah, I pulled out a few quotes. This is in regard to Teela when they landed on the ring floor. This is after she was crying when he, which is pretty cruel, right? He encourages her to climb on these black lava walls, even though he knows it's going to burn her, just to teach her a lesson. And he, and after she's been crying, he's like, her lips, this is a narrator, her lips, he saw, were perfect for pouting. She was one of those rare, lucky women whom crying does not make ugly.
Yeah.
And then later on that same passage, he's like, we need you to keep me happy so I don't rape Nessus.
Oh.
And there's a couple of references to, like, him, you know, not being able to control himself. And I mean, I guess that's a terrible portrayal of masculinity, too, that if it weren't for, like, her early on, as if her, she's needed on this journey just to keep him happy. And one of those things is so he doesn't, he's not overly aggressive kind of male, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you say? Yeah, here it is, pretty clear. And yes, I read the whole book. So when I come to those places in a story, should I just stop reading? Oh, should I read with caution?
Yeah, that's the question. I don't know. To me, it doesn't ruin a work for me. I think it's noteworthy. Sometimes it warrants more or less discussion. Here, you know, maybe part I don't know if I prepared as much to talk about it. Yeah, you know, I found to me it's a little bit of, there's an element of caricature or exaggeration, almost for the first Star Trek series, in which some things are, or let's say early James Bond, early Star Trek, where it's almost comical or ridiculous. It's some kind of adolescent male fantasy that but it's easy for me to say that as a male. I'm not, I guess, to not draw more umbrage with it. But yeah, I don't think it, to me, it's not a matter of, I think it's still, I wouldn't stop reading. Neither of us stop reading.
It's a question.
Yeah.
That's a question to ask. Yes, there have been some stories, some books that I've just put down because it didn't appeal to me. That's what we would say. Or I was offended by it. Not too many, though. If I'm going to, I look through lots of books before I pick up one that I'm going to read. So I've made some kind of commitment at the beginning. And then when you begin, after you start reading it and you invest yourself into that story and the characters come out like that, there's a decision to be made. And it's a good thing to talk about it in advance, because then your decision becomes more complicated and I think better. If you're going to read it or not.
Well, it doesn't say much about maybe the view of humanity that, like, say they land on Ringworld, they've just seen these natives, and the first thing they do is grab a blanket and go off into the woods to have sex. Like, their animal instincts, the puppeteer, maybe that's why the puppeteer is so powerful, because the puppet cautious and thinking, and at least we don't, from the narration, we don't know what the puppeteer does when they land on Ringworld, when they finally set down, but we know what... I shouldn't say when they finally sit down, when they finally get into those fly cycles, and then they see those natives working in the stream, and they land. And the first thing that Lewis and Teela do is grab a blanket and go off into the woods to copulate, as Nessie says. And then the first thing that the speaker does is grin, like, this is like Alice in Wonderland, look at, you know, the Cheshire cat, and then run off in the woods after a rabbit. You know? Chases a rabbit. Yeah, I want to read a little bit from there. It's, what does Ness say? You amaze me. So Ness says, no known sentient species copulates as often as you do. Go then. Use caution where you sit. Remember that unfamiliar life forms are about. And then it goes on, next page. A woman seems to blaze with angelic glory. And there's ellipses. Something the size of a rabbit shot out of the trees, scampered across Lewis's chest, and was gone into the undergrowth. An instant later, speaker to animals bounded into view. Excuse me, the Kazin called and was gone, hot on the scent. I think that was one of my one of my favorite moments in the whole book. I just thought, what a funny scene. Yeah. Just after first contact, really. I mean, like, I haven't met him yet, but like seeing these natives, and that's the next, the scene that follows.
Yeah. Yeah. But, or do you think this is just an author's manipulation of the times where he has to put in something, you know, he has to put in a sex scene or two sell the book?
Totally, totally. Yeah, it could definitely be that. Yeah, and then it's like pause for commercial break, and then they're meeting the natives. There's a page break literally right after that. Yeah, that was great. I started keeping like a column going of different, and you mentioned this at the very beginning of this discussion, like different kind of science fiction machines or devices or like sci-fi. Would it be a device or what do they call it in drama? Like a
prop?
Yeah, I guess it could be a prop. Like, maybe it's just a device, like a dramatic device. Maybe that's making too much of it. But so here's some examples. And then let's talk about the task and we can come back to these. So these are, I feel like I might be missing one or two. But I wrote down on a little post-it here, the slide walks, transfer booth, the drinking kind of bulb, booster spice, the reading screen, fairy chess, the hyperspace, stepping discs, fly cycles, and then any other ones that come to mind?
Well, part of the fly cycles had supposedly amazing med kits. And also,
they could all fly in a diamond.
Yes.
Almost like a...
But they had food processors too, food makers. So you put in whatever organic and...
The brick. You get like a food brick.
Yeah. But those things were very important in this episode.
Yeah. Plateau trance. I guess it's not really a device, but something like that, you know, in terms of, again, what do we call those lists? But... a few words, you know, that go together that encompass all of those. But in Star Trek, they used to have those. I think they actually worked like a closed passage or a Mad Lib, and they used to fill it in with sci-fi speak on the Star Treks. I think some of those little inventions are pretty worthy of a list to discuss a few of them and highlight them. It's kind of, I don't know, I always find those really fun.
Interesting. This was written in 1970. And making a list like that, it'd be fun also to check off which ones are true now, not science fiction anymore.
Yeah, like the reading screen, for example, or even a slidewalk. I don't know if there were, like you'd see at the airport.
Yeah.
What do we call those things now? What do you call it? Like a...
Conveyor?
What are the ones that you walk on that are not... I mean, escalator.
Escalator.
Are those also escalators? The ones that go up, right? Yeah, I love that idea. Yeah, which ones were prescient and
all right.
Which ones have yet to be reality.
All right, so let's stick with machines.
So the tap.
Yeah.
What an interesting device.
More effective than any projectile weapon, I think.
I guess we should say what the TASP does. So the TASP being, what is it, like an embedded sensor or embedded transmitter? That it's embedded into, it was underneath one of his, like around his neck, is that right?
Oh, I can't remember where it was embedded, but it was the puppeteer had it embedded, I think, because it didn't want anybody to take it away and use it on him, maybe.
Right.
That's it.
So it was cut off at the end. But we've got, and then the weighing that this, I've never heard of this kind of, but it's almost like one of those remote controlled vibrator or some kind of thing where, you know, the way that it would cause pain is through absolute pleasure, right?
Yeah.
Meanly like in sexual ecstasy kind of pleasure.
What people say about heroin and some of those kinds of drugs, between all of those kinds of ways that you can receive pleasure, the TASP in my mind was like 100 times more than that. And such a dangerous thing, he could dial it up and down.
Right.
So I only gave you a little bit of it. And look how you feel. That would be
manipulation that you don't realize why you're feeling charmed by someone or feel good in their presence. There's some kind of psycho. It's almost a hypnotism, or that comes up once or twice. I think in the book too, the idea of hypnosis. that I'm trying to understand that. And I suppose that some figures can play God in a way. We're all manipulated by, if we don't understand it, we're manipulated by the way that people communicate with us. If I were, you think of like advice for a job interview, and you're meant to mirror the body language of the person who's interviewing you, right? To like, in their subconscious, help them understand that you're with them, that you're reflecting what they value.
Yeah, exactly. How do you know?
Yeah.
In other words, yeah, it's like Helen Keller at that wow moment. How do you do that? And that's, I think, when an author can do that as you're reading, and you get the feeling that alien are working with that kind of, and we as humans are working to understand them, it makes it easier, I think, to believe it when and if it really happens.
Yeah, that would be something disturbing to realize. You have those aha moments, right, where you're reading some kind of text about social media or something. I can think of that when how different sites or apps, say Instagram, Facebook, who else does this? I think Twitter does it, where they delay the notification by a couple of, like over a second. So when you open the app, you can't see for a long second whether or not you have anything new. And there's that rush before you see it.
Oh, yeah.
Because they don't need to do that. Yeah. It could appear instantaneously, but instead they delay it on purpose so that there's this moment of anticipation that's totally contrived, and yet it just works.
Okay, the TASP gets a check next to the developing in the world right now.
Yeah, I can see that. But you can imagine a place in which you, right, where you're walking through, I think we're not far off from that with advertising, where not only would you get images that are unique to you based on maybe facial recognition or whatever, but also there might be some kind of sound or voice that your inner ear picks up that gives you a subliminal message that you're not even recognizing, so that when you walk by an ad for a particular product, maybe you feel like you have this sudden urge for whatever that is, right? Or just a good feeling associated with that product you just looked at that you're not aware of.
Oh, yeah. I believe it. There have been many movies that show that. Which one was it? The remake of the one about Mars and the air. Total Recall had a lot of that in it.
Yeah. Minority Report had some things in it.
Oh, yes. Have you walked into a nice hotel and felt better because it has this atomizer fragrance in the air?
I definitely always do notice the shift in atmosphere when I walk into a nice hotel, which is remarkable.
So I think that's manipulation too.
Yeah, definitely.
The TASP makes our list. What else you got from machines?
I think that one is worthy of so much discussion. Now, that one's probably that one, and I guess the booster spice, not a machine exactly, but a device, a sci-fi invention, is pretty fascinating. The idea of being able to take something that would prolong your life. And I don't think we're that far off from that either.
But who gets to take it?
Yeah, that's the question. Only those with insurance. Yeah.
Ha. Yeah. And then once you are at that level of immortality, then I think the playing eugenics isn't too far off.
Right. Yeah, I think that's not too far off either, just because are we, that's a big discussion, but if you knew your child would have some particular disorder, right, wouldn't you make the choice to remove that or fill in whatever you need to do to fix that?
If it's offered, at what price and to whom? That's a big question.
Yeah. Those are hard questions to answer. I don't know how. I guess it's having, we both have children, and so knowing what if, it's hard. I guess I probably might have seen that a bit differently until I had a kid, perhaps. Because anything I would do to not lose my own child would be I'd probably do whatever it takes. I guess up to a certain point, like I wouldn't sacrifice. But let's say you had one child that you lost because they had some kind of curable, but something they were born with that you knew they would only live to be 12. Well, you would just cure that. But if you had to make that decision before they were born, it's easier to understand that having lost a child, right? Or having had a child, you wouldn't want to lose. And I guess collectively as a human race, we understand that. And why wouldn't we do that? But it's a sense of playing. The hard thing is, where are the limits, right? Where do you limit? That's always the question, right?
Yeah.
I guess that's the beauty of sci-fi. You're pushing the limits.
That's exactly why I love science fiction. One of the reasons.
Yeah. And I guess to come back to maybe an earlier, to bring this back to an earlier, some earlier thinking in terms of should, so if somebody, if Niven's writing this or Heinlein's writing certain things, and I'm sure we'll come across other authors of classic works that are living in a different time and exploring ideas that are, you know, more controversial now than they were then. If not for the exploration of those ideas, that's kind of like pretty edgy comedy, right? I mean, but you want to, in order to progress, to stretch the imagination and learn, you have to push some ideas that maybe, you know, maybe aren't quite right or go a little too far sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yes, I totally see what you mean. But in the instance of Heinlein and Niven, the ones that we've talked about, could also be devices that these guys just have been told to put in because they sell books at that time.
Yeah.
And I don't think the publishers would say the same things to authors these days, but I believe the author or the publishers do push authors to different directions or to do things that an author might not do right away just to sell them.
That's a good point. Yeah, I can see that. Cynical.
Right. That's a cynical.
No, I think, but there's truth there, and yeah, I can see that. I guess I was thinking a little more about the eugenics idea because that's such a, you know, such a something important to discuss, I think, still versus say things that are clearly kind of sexist in retrospect. And
so the story's worth it because of those kinds of things.
Well, I think what I'm kind of arguing or wondering if it still gets people thinking about ideas that are, you know, that help us think about something like eugenics, which is still a real that's still, it does happen to some degree and will continue to happen. That's worth discussing or worth,
I think so,
challenging yourself on.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Any other kind of machines or things that you were struck by?
Ring World itself was a machine, or is a machine. Mm-hmm. And how the author described the scope and the, not construction, but ideas that put this together, some construction, is amazing, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, some of that was a little beyond me, I think.
What about the thread that cut off the wing of their flyer, the Lyre,
yeah,
their spaceship? I think that's close, if not being developed, we're close to developing something like that. I've seen some of those How You Make It or Next
Really?
Invention shows that show this super kind of thread that you can make bulletproof vests out of and things like that. But think of it on the scope of millions of miles. What could you do? You could hold together panels that would shade a sun. That's an amazing machine there.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that would protect, and not only protect from, say, UV rays, but also to work as solar energy that might be living under some kind of living under a ring rather than on it.
Yeah. And how Larry Niven, the author, sold the idea of the ring world to me as their spaceship flew under the ring and you could see the dents of the oceans and the pokes of the mountains and how they saw the width as being as great as I would ever think, but then there was the length of it. So I was totally with the whole ring part of this novel, I bought that idea, though I think there probably are some technical difficulties with the idea of it. But I, as a reader, I bought that whole idea. I'm going to take us back to the ideas of eugenics, for me, was the biggest part of this story.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah, I think the theme of fate, luck versus freedom, free will. And yeah, I think that to me, that's the most powerful piece of that. And then eugenics is a way, I mean, it works in tandem with that. In regard to the ring as well, I buy into it. I mean, I don't know if my knowledge of science is such that I'm skeptical of a whole lot. I think it's pretty clear that there's a lot of fantasy here. And that's not real hard based on hard science. And I think that for me, that's fine. That's the fiction part of science fiction. And I was pretty happy to just to be along for the ride. Yeah, I thought that was interesting that it took us like about half the book before we arrived at Ringworld.
Honestly, I was surprised too. And then I was kind of disappointed. I wanted to go around the whole ring like a carnival ride, but we didn't get very far at all, really. Lucky to escape with our lives.
Yeah, there was moments there where it reminded me, reminds you of so many books, but there was quite a bit that reminded me of Gulliver's Travels.
Oh.
You remember they have that like island in the sky, Laputa, with those flying, I guess that's another piece that was into those flying buildings and flying cities.
Oh, yeah.
Which I didn't quite understand how that worked exactly, other than they were, like how they were able to stay up. And obviously when they ran out of, energy, I thought that was a really, I was trying to picture how I would depict that in some artwork or something. The idea that these flying glass kind of castle had all crashed into these cities. I thought that was a cool mental image of these crashed castles, castles.
You'll be able to see it on TV soon.
How fun to depict that. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So we predict crashed. We talked about this earlier. What do we predict in the series? And one of them is to see how the cities are crashed to the other city and the beneath them.
Yeah. What else are we going to see? Yeah, definitely some version of those fly cycles. Yeah, the TASP scenes. I mean, that's got to be there, right? Interesting. It would take some special acting to pull that off, I think. What else are we going to see? Yeah, the depiction of the puppeteer will be
interesting. I think that's essential. If they mess that up, then I'm not watching it. Yeah, just not doing it. Okay, here's a good prediction. This is only a yes or no question. Sex scenes, yes or no?
No. I think it has to do with where it's being published. It's on the Sci-Fi Network, which tends to be, I might be being a little too old school in my thinking there, because I think we were both watching this.
Carbon.
Altered Carbon.
Altered Carbon.
Was that on the Sci-Fi? No, it was like HBO or Showtime or something. It's on Netflix now, but I think it wasn't.
Okay, so your answer is depending on what network has created this.
I think we're going to get that, but we're not going to be, it won't be like, there won't be the nudity that's described in the book. I was trying to think of that. What's that series where they're like, this is a terrible description. They're like, I just started watching the beginning of it, never followed through. And it was good. We talked about it. It's like they're flying, starts off with some space ship it's not lost in space.
Everybody's on a spaceship. Is this Serenity? That's a good one.
Yeah, but it has been canceled a couple times, but Sci-Fi folks are really into it.
Oh, is this kind of the parody on Star Trek?
The Expanse.
Oh, yes, I've seen all the seasons.
And there's some scene. I think that's side of the Sci-Fi Channel, and there's some scenes in that where they're big about. I think they're, if I remember right, they're about as nude as you can be without a full kind of exposure.
Okay, so you're saying yes.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Now I think about it. Yeah, I think that'll be there. But I think they're gonna. It will be very contemporary in the sense that say a Tila Brown may not even. She might have the same name. Even her name is a bit caricatured, I would say, where those characters are given a bit more power and flushed out a bit more. So I would predict that they'll have more.
So you're changing the story. So this story's already been changed
entirely, but that there'll just be a little more complexity to those characters, and I would say maybe a little less. Yeah, yeah, they won't be quite so helpless, and I don't see maybe a Lewis character. Okay, here's a question. I was going to say a Lewis character will be a little bit less arrogant, but I think there's a way in which you can play that character as being like the swashbuckling, arrogant type that kind of learns his lessons, like a Han Solo type.
Okay.
Will he be of Chinese heritage?
Ah.
I would say that's a good question.
There's a comedian. I can't remember his name right now. He's been on The Daily Show a few times. He has his own stand-up. He's Asian. This guy is edgy and hilarious, and he's got to be the main character here for Lewis. He'd be perfect.
I think I know who you're talking about. I can't think of his name right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get it later.
His family's from Pakistan originally, right?
Oh, I don't know that. No, this guy... Yeah, I think he's from California.
Oh. Beck's from, is it Tony Chang or something?
Yes.
He's Australian.
Oh, yes, he is Australian.
I know he's playing a role, but I don't see him as, I guess, mask is the way, I mean, he plays this kind of feminine type on The Daily Show, and I've seen those excerpts. I don't know.
Huh? What?
Were you thinking the same guy?
I don't think so.
Huh.
Is this the guy on Saturday Night Live you're thinking of?
No. I think the guy that's on The Daily Show.
You changed the story with Tila. I can change the story with...
I'm not saying it should be changed. I'm just saying I could see... Well, I think they should change the Tila a little bit. But I guess that, you know, the thing that will make that different is... We're not going to get the narration. And we're really talking about the narration. Third person, it's mostly limited, almost entirely limited to Lewis. And
that's so true.
Yeah, so we're in his mind. And so it's like the Lewis's interpretation of things. And we're not going to get that with a TV show. And so the reason why Tila is partly portrayed that way is because it's Lewis's thoughts about Tila, right?
So you don't think you can get that in a TV show?
Good question.
That narration.
Well, you could. Well, I don't think we will get it. I think it's not that you can't. I just think that's not. You don't typically get that, right?
It's super important how the character of Lewis is played because he's heavy on the narration. A lot of it will focus around him and how the writers change the story, fit what he says and how he acts and what he does.
Yeah, I hope they choose someone. I like it when things are pretty authentic, personally. So I would love to see them choose what we think. Yeah, I mean some kind of prominent Asian actor in his leading role, East Asian actor. That would be awesome.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Fun to see. Okay, so we're both saying Lewis is Asian. He's going to look Asian.
Happen, but I hope so. What genres do we have here? So it's First Contact, in a way.
Yeah, that's definitely First Contact. No. Yeah, when they hit Ringworld, First Contact. But First Contact of aliens to humans, not really. So yeah. I would say no, not First Contact.
We get alien encounters.
Yes. Oh, space opera for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely space opera.
And continuing in the next book or two or three.
Yeah, I guess that's probably it. Yeah?
Yeah, right. I think so.
And then the other thing is, what are we thinking for our next book? Or did we already decide that? I've forgotten.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Okay, all right. That sounds good. And then I think we just need to coordinate which... I was trying to find, because that's a work in translation, let's try to read the same one.
I'll send you a picture of my cover and all of that stuff. I don't have it with me right now, but...
Okay, maybe we can...
I will do that today.
Share even the first page just to double check.
Good first page.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Wow. Okay, that's going way back. Verne.
Interesting to see some of the themes that we've already talked about, and whether how he treats his characters.
Now, you've read this in the past at some point?
Oh, so many years ago. So I don't remember the book as well as I remember the movie, and that was a Disney movie. So I can't. I think it's going to be pretty far away from what the story is. But I remember the big points, and I think it's going to be. I think you're going to like it.
Cool. Yeah, I'm excited. Yeah, it's been on my list forever. I just have never read it, so excited.
Well, you just had a trip to the beach, a vacation on the beach and the ocean and all of that, and that's, you know, where most of this story, if not all of it, takes place, is the ocean.
Right, right. Yeah, it's something that we have yet to fully explore to this day.
Have you ever been on
it? Not only... You know, one of those ones that's parked, that's docked, and you can check out. Yeah, I've never been on a moving submarine.
Yeah. Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Looking forward to it. Still need to work on that sign-off. What if we read the end of each book, would that make sense? We can never go back. No, of course not. Not until we can deliver our secret to our respective worlds and acquire an intact ship. How are we going to get that ship?
The secrets. What are the secrets? The hyperdrive that goes so many light years in a second, or it's some fantastic thing, right? Or the secrets of how their lives have been manipulated by the puppeteer race species. How are we being manipulated right now?
Ending with some questions.